Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, for many of you, school started in the last couple of weeks. And if you remember, or maybe this is your experience in the last couple of weeks, what it's like to be a new kid at a new school. Usually you show up and your teacher will tell you where to sit. And there's something comforting about that. You know exactly what you're supposed to do and exactly where you're supposed to be. But then recess comes, and then there's lunch. And you wonder, what am I supposed to be doing? Is there a place for me? Is there someone I can talk to? Am I sitting in the right place? Am I saying the right thing? Do I know the right games? And there's this radical self-consciousness that very often overcomes someone who's the new kid in a new school. Now, lest you think that this experience goes away once you graduate, it doesn't. Because there are mixers in your college dorm to think about. And there are office parties in your new job to think about. There are neighborhood barbecues to think about. There are your kids' sporting events to think about. And when you're thrust into a social situation with really little awareness of the nature of the social situation and the people who are gathered, it can often be overwhelming to know what to do, to know ultimately if you have a place. And of course, I find this to be true at churches as well. This is one of three times during the year where people will often visit churches. In the fall, people are kind of getting back into the rhythm. Maybe they've moved, starting school in a new place. We often see people show up to church for the first time around Christmas or around Easter for obvious reasons. But it's a risk to show up at a new church because, again, you don't know the people. You don't know the place. Every congregation has its own culture and assumed values that maybe are often unarticulated. And to be the new person on your first Sunday involves all sorts of risks. And you throw in someone who may be introverted by nature and is slightly socially awkward by nature, and this can be overwhelming. But at the end of the day, I think that all of this becomes an illustration of our own individual relationship with God. How is it that I, as a human being, can stand in a relationship with a God who created me, with a God who created the universe? What does it mean for me? Do I have a place? Do I know what to do? Do I know how to behave? Do I have what it takes to stand in the presence of the God who made me, of the God who made the universe? And Jesus is getting at something like that in our gospel text today. Luke chapter 14, we see that the text in the bulletin is divided up verse 1 of chapter 14, and then it skips to verse 7 and goes through from verses 7 to 14. So it's nice to have a Bible with you just in case the lectionary is trying to trick you with these sorts of things. So never a bad thing to have a Bible at church, right? Nevertheless, Jesus is having lunch with a prominent Pharisee. And it's important to know that Jesus was a suspicious character in the eyes of many religious leaders at the time. Jesus had a habit of transgressing social boundaries and social customs, and Jesus had a habit of attracting all sorts of strange people to him. And so you notice that the text says that the leading Pharisee invited him over for lunch after the Sabbath service, but they were watching him closely. They were interested, they were intrigued by this rabbi from Nazareth. And they'd heard stories, no doubt, about him doing unconventional things and being present with unconventional people in very shocking ways. And so a man with dropsy shows up at this meal. There is no way that this man was invited to the meal. No way. His medical condition would have made the whole place ceremonially unclean. And so the Pharisees, who emphasized cleanliness and purity above all else, would never have approved of a man with dropsy in their midst. Now, the medical people in our midst know more about dropsy than I do, but it's a condition of swelling that's caused usually by a kidney or a heart problem. And so the man with dropsy was no doubt physically misshapen because he was swollen, retaining all sorts of fluid, and people with dropsy have insatiable thirst because they're not able to process water appropriately. So he would not have been on the guest list of the Pharisee. And I think that this is important for us to know and to really think about and be courageous enough to ask ourselves this question. Notice that wherever Jesus went, he attracted all sorts of people that were excluded from the mainstream of day-to-day life. He attracted sick people, he attracted tax collectors, he attracted prostitutes. Those were the kind of people that sought Jesus out. And so the question that I think we need to be courageous enough to ask is, if we as a congregation are reflecting and embodying and incarnating the presence of Jesus in our neighborhoods, are those kinds of people seeking us out? The Pharisees, when they invited Jesus to come to dinner, may have thought to themselves, well, inviting Jesus, we're taking a little bit of a risk, but who in the world is going to show up because he's here? Now, that may be the real risk. So it's worth pausing and asking ourselves that question. Jesus attracted these sorts of people. Are these the sorts of people that are attracted to us? So Jesus has them right where he wants them at this point, because here's a sick man, and the Pharisees would love for this man to be made well, because then the ceremonially unclean nature of their gathering would go away. But at the same time, it was understood that to heal someone on the Sabbath was actually working, and you couldn't work on the Sabbath. And so the crowd was wondering, what is Jesus going to do? It'd be great to have him healed, but at the same time, it's inappropriate to have him healed. And so Jesus brings healing to the man's body. And then he gets on the Pharisees and says, listen, if it's the Sabbath day and your son fell in a well, would you reach down and pick him up or not? I mean, that would be work, but you'd be saving someone's life. This man is not well. His physical body is killing him. And is it right on the Sabbath to restore this man's life, to bring him to health or not? And of course, they don't have anything to say to that. But then Jesus has their attention, and he begins to talk to them. And he tells two parables. The literary unit here goes from verse 1 all the way to verse 24. We just have a little piece of it in the lectionary today. But there are three stories now about banquets. And we have two of them in our text today. And Jesus tells this parable. Well, when you go to a banquet, don't choose the high place. Choose the low place. Because the last thing you'd want is for the host to come and say, you're sitting in the wrong place, go sit at the low place. Now, you need to understand that in the first century, and this is true in some cultures today, some cultures, insular cultures like certain business cultures, but also cultures around the world, that where you sit at these sorts of banquets is very important. How close to the host are you sitting? And if you're sitting very close to the host, you know you're very important in that context. If you're sitting far away from the host, you know that you just barely made the invite list, right? And so your instinct might be to say, I want to get as close to the host as I can, because that will demonstrate to the people around me that I'm an important person. And so you go and sit there. But Jesus says the last thing you want to do is sit too close to the host, and then the host comes over and says, hey, what are you doing? I don't even know you that well. Go sit over here. And that would be humiliating, and that you don't want to be humiliated. But then Jesus shifts it and says, now, host, when you throw a banquet, don't invite your friends, don't invite your families, don't invite your wealthy neighbors, because they are more than likely to repay you. Because, the first century functioned, the first century Jewish community and Greco-Roman society did this too. There was this really important practice of reciprocity, that if somebody does something for you, you're obligated in a lot of ways to reciprocate and do it to them. So if you're hosting a party, you invite your close friends and you invite your family, but maybe you have kind of like you applied to Stanford, right? It's the stretch, you know, you applied to Princeton, but then you applied to some other schools that you know you could get into, but this is the stretch. So maybe you invite this guy who's a couple steps higher than you on the totem pole in your society in hopes that he would show up at your banquet, because then maybe he might invite you to the next one. So all that to say is that in the culture into which Jesus was speaking, there was this really strong focus on social standing and where you stood relative to your neighbors, where you stood relative to your family, where you stood relative to your coworkers. So there was this radical self-consciousness among people when they were interacting with one another socially. And the idea was to climb that ladder of social prominence and social influence. Now you notice then that in this context, the people who get totally left behind are the people who are completely unable to reciprocate. And so if you're poor, if you're sick, if you're a widow, if you're a stranger, you have no means whereby to reciprocate these kinds of invitations. Therefore, you're completely shut out of the system. But Jesus says that these are parables. They're meant to represent something else. And what I believe that Jesus is communicating to these Pharisees and the Pharisees' guests is that the way that God's kingdom works is radically different than they're expecting. And it all starts with this man being healed from dropsy. But they're curious as to whether or not Jesus is going to heal this man on the Sabbath, because it would be inappropriate for a healing to take place on the Sabbath. But Jesus says, nope, in God's kingdom, when we see our sons and our daughters fall in a pit, we reach down and save them. It doesn't matter which day it is. In God's kingdom, we take the things that are broken and restore them. That's where everything starts in God's kingdom. And then, as we go and reflect on that healing, Jesus says that it's essential that when we come into a given situation, we understand our brokenness, our need. We realize that we actually don't belong in the high place because we are broken people. We're like the man with dropsy. But what we're longing for as we take the low place is for the host to come and to call us to himself. We don't deserve to be called by the host, but we're longing to be called by the host. And as we're in that place, then Jesus shifts and says, okay, now I'm going to talk to you hosts out there. You hosts are in the habit of finding people just like you, and maybe a little bit better than you, to invite to your meals. But a true host goes and finds those who cannot reciprocate. The true host goes and he finds the broken, the sick, the poor, the lame, the widows. Those are the kinds of people that the true host will invite, will seek out. And so if you've been following Jesus' logic here, you get to the place where you think, oh my goodness, I have dropsy. I'm the one that should be excluded. I'm the one that when I think about coming into the presence of the God who created me should back away because I'm broken and I'm sinful and I'm not the kind of person that should sit at the table in Jesus' kingdom. But then Jesus works with us and says, yes, you realize that you're broken. And yes, you realize that you shouldn't take the high place. And yes, you're longing for the host to come and to call you up to that place of prominence. And then the true host is actually the kind of person that does just that. And so as Jesus is doing this, he's subverting the whole practice of jockeying for social prominence and the ethos of reciprocity. He's completely subverting those things. He's actually encouraging people to understand themselves as the kind of people that should sit at the low place, and also encouraging people to pursue those who have no capacity to reciprocate. In other words, on a spiritual level, people like us. I'm mindful of George Herbert, that great Anglican poet and pastor, has this beautiful poem on love. And if I were an eighth grader at Great Hearts, I probably would have memorized this, but I don't have it all memorized. But the poem begins by with these great words: love bade me welcome, but I pulled away. Why did he pull away? Because of his sin, his guilt. He doesn't deserve to be in the presence of love. But as love interacts with the poet, we see that love bore the guilt. We see that love bore the shame. And so then love bids again. And in its beautiful line, Herbert ends this poem by saying, I did sit and eat. And so the poet, broken, sinful George Herbert, was bid to come into the presence of love. He was aware that he was broken, aware that he was sinful, that he had no right to be there. But love comes, bears the guilt, bears the shame, sets the table. And then we become the kind of people who sit and eat. And of course, this is what we do every Sunday at the Eucharist. Before we come to the table, we kneel and say, we are not worthy to come to your table. But only in your abundant and great mercies are we able to come. We're broken people, we're sinful people, who because of that cannot stand in the presence of the God who created us. And yet, when we experience ourselves as broken and sinful, we find that we're even more greatly and deeply loved by the one who gives himself, who bears our guilt, who bears our shame, who becomes incarnate, and whose broken body and shed blood we receive Sunday after Sunday. And as this happens, we become the kind of people who no longer are enslaved to a radical self-consciousness that insists that our identity and our value is determined by where we fall in a given social pecking order. We become the kind of people who show up to unfamiliar social situations, and rather than being overwhelmed by wanting somehow to fit in and to know exactly what to do, we begin to look for those who are on the outside, who are on the margins, because we become the kind of people who seek out those who are broken. We become the kind of people who are always on the lookout for those on the fringes, who those who may be estranged or may be alienated, because we're broken too. A couple of weeks ago, the New Yorker did a profile of Bryan Stevenson, who wrote a book called Just Mercy. If you haven't read it, it's a beautiful but very hard book to read. And Bryan Stevenson runs a group called the Equal Justice Initiative. He defends death row prisoners. And he discovered along the way that a lot of people on death row had been wrongly convicted. And he put a lot of his life into defending people who had been wrongly convicted and who were on death row. And people look at Bryan Stevenson and say, wow, what a heroic, strong, tough guy. And the journalist from the New Yorker, Stevenson's a committed Christian, by the way, was looking at him and say, wow, I can't believe how strong and how tough you are. And he just looked at the guy and said, you know, I do what I do because I'm broken too. I do what I do because I'm broken too. And so this morning, hear love bid you welcome. inevitably, as you hear that, there's an awareness. I'm not quite sure that I'm worthy to stand in the presence of love because of my sin, because of my brokenness. But hear love pursue you even more and say, I bore the guilt, I bore the shame. Sit and eat my meat, love says. And you, with George Herbert and Brian Stevenson, can say, I did sit and eat. Amen.